From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. I can't thank you enough for the support you give to us and the encouragement that you offer to us. For more information on how you can keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Sundown Wednesday brings the Jewish New Year celebration of Rosh Hashanah. Thursday is the start of the Hindu celebration of Shardiya Navratri, and the equinox on Friday will be marked as Mabon and Astara in the Wicca and pagan traditions. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Well, this sand here tells you that the water was flowing right over this busy intersection here in downtown Houston.
The U.S. received a 1-2 punch from Mother Nature that left millions of Americans without power or worse. While other communities suffered even greater devastation, the recovery efforts needed in the aftermath of Harvey and Irma are almost impossible to achieve. On this week's show, I'll talk with the Reverend Gregory Hahn, Director of Interfaith Relations at Interfaith Ministries for Greater Houston.
White Americans will ultimately be not only a minority in the nation that our people founded, but a tiny minority, well on its way to political and physical obliteration.
Minorities increasing in population so rapidly that they are going to be the main voice of this country.
Chanting, "You will not replace us." These white guys are afraid of being replaced in some fashion.
America is no longer a white Christian country, and that's going to have profound implications.
Also, Dr. Robert Jones from the Public Religion Research Institute. Recent findings from PRRI starkly expose just how out of step with the majority of Americans the current administration's approaches to race and religion really are. But first,
a power prayer took place in the Oval Office, laying hands and praying for our president. Supernatural wisdom, guidance, and protection while we are going to see another spiritual awakening.
When those photographs of evangelical leaders surrounding Donald Trump in the Oval Office get published, Americans have a strong reaction. A certain number think, "Yay, that's our guy." Many others shudder and think, "What on earth has happened to our country?" But both reactions are largely based on assumptions and stereotypes of who those leaders are and what they want for our nation. It is critical to understand who these people are and what they want. Joining me now is Religion News Service Editor-in-Chief Jerome Sokolowski, who shares the byline on this article with three RNS writers. Jerome, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's wonderful to be with you again, Welton.
I've talked a little about why I think it's so important to know the figures profiled in your comprehensive piece, but I want to know why you thought it was so important to do this.
I thought essentially that this was in our wheelhouse. These are people that we cover. We talk to them often, and we see them, as you mentioned, there were these photos popping up of prayer sessions in the Oval Office and meetings, smiling evangelical leaders in the Eisenhower building, the building next door to the White House, where White House staff have their offices. We would see these images coming out, and there were, you know, stories that we did and others did on the actual meetings or encounters between the president or Jared Kushner, his son-in-law and advisor, and Mike Pence, the vice president, and others. But I felt that the overarching picture was absent of what is going on here. Why are so many conservative evangelical leaders showing up at the White House with such frequency? And the other aspect of it was that there was no official advisory board, and also that they are all pretty much without exception of a conservative political and religious bent.
Talk about the Advisors Council during the presidential campaign and how that led to the current informal group that we see today.
There was an official advisory council that was formed during the election campaign, the Trump campaign appointed. There were, I believe, 25 members of that advisory board. And that, if my memory serves me correctly, it was after the tape recording emerged of President Trump talking about women in a was it the Hollywood Access tape, talking about groping women. Perhaps he saw a need to have a discussion with spiritual leaders. He got together with around 1,000 evangelicals in New York, and after that formed this 25 or so member advisory council. And that council was officially disbanded when he became president, but many of the same people have continued to advise him in this unofficial capacity. And I should say, it's not unusual for presidents to have spiritual advisors, to meet with spiritual leaders, and it's not even unusual for them to be of one faith tradition. What is unusual here is the frequency and that they really are seeking to influence policy as much as they seem to be interested in the spiritual well-being of the president. One thing that President Obama did was actually form a spiritual advisory council. There is a law, actually, a sunshine law, which if the president has an advisory council or a committee or a body, an official body, there has to be some transparency. There has to be, public notes about the meetings. We need to be able to be informed about that. But since this is unofficial, no one is really under any obligation to tell us what they talk about. But we were able to talk to many people, and they were happy to talk about it.
Who is driving this? Is it being driven by the White House and what the president gets from these conversations, or is it being driven from a group of pastors who are entranced, I guess I would say, with the power that they're close to? Who's keeping it going?
I think it takes two to tango. I mean, we were told, at least by the participants, that the White House officials do take the initiative to organize some of the meetings. And Mike Pence has been involved, Jared Kushner, as I mentioned before. There's the White House Office of Public Liaison who's there, and we were told that there are White House officials there taking copious notes and passing them on to the relevant departments. We're also told that there are a few of the spiritual advisors who are leading the effort, and one of them is, we were told, Paula White, the prosperity gospel preacher from Florida. Another is Johnny Moore, who was made a minister by Jerry Falwell Sr., I think a decade or so ago, and now he's a public relations consultant in Washington, and he's the informal spokesman of the group as well. And then there's Tim Clinton, who is from a Christian counseling organization, a national organization that's involved in that.
I wonder if you ask these people the question, what's the purpose of your meeting in the White House? Would they say to encourage the spiritual growth of the president, or would they say to help get some important parts of our agenda into conversation and maybe into law?
We did ask that question, and we went further. We asked the question that many people have on their mind of how can you work with someone who, during and after the campaign, how can you work with someone who is certainly not a paragon of Christian virtue has not been in his own life and his dealings with women, and allegedly also in his dealings in his business dealings. And then we also asked it after Charlottesville of if other advisory councils, specifically two economic advisory councils that the president had fell apart because of criticism by members on those panels over how he responded to Charlottesville. Why do you continue to be involved in this effort? And essentially what they said is they cast themselves in a prophetic role. We are not yes men to the president. One of the pastors, Tony Suarez, who's a Hispanic preacher, he compared himself to the prophet Nathan, who confronted King David in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, over his seduction of the wife of one of his generals. Nathan didn't say when King David slept with the wife Bathsheba, this is the quote, he didn't say, "We're done, bud, we're done with you." He did call the king out and say, "Thou art the man." So they tell us that they're criticizing the president or speaking truth to power in a way. I have to say that we didn't actually find evidence of it in what they told us. There were some cases, for example, with the DACA, the rescinding of the Dreamers Act. Two of the Hispanic advisors said that they were able to get the six-month delay in implementation of that from the president, that they did criticize the president over that. But it is, as we all know, that is going through. So, you know, there is some question as to how much they really are accomplishing of their goals.
Has there been a president in our history that was so literally and figuratively surrounded by religious right figures?
There has not by any account that we have. We have the people like Richard Land, who used to be, the Southern Baptist man in Washington, saying we're getting unprecedented access here. This has gone beyond what took place in the Bush or either of the Bush or Reagan administrations, certainly any of the most recent Republican administrations. Some people see it as a huge paradox that it is occurring under the presidency of Donald Trump, but that is what's going on. They went so far as during a recent visit to the Oval Office just after Hurricane Harvey hit Texas, they did a prayer for the victims of Hurricane Harvey, and one of the pastors from Texas, Robert Jeffress, he cast the president as a kind of national savior. He said, "Dear Lord, thank you. You have given us a gift, President Donald Trump," you know, noting in the prayer that America, in his description, has been bitterly divided for decades upon decades. So they really see him as a kind of savior, not just for themselves, but for the country.
Hmm. Do you know if there are tensions with evangelical leaders who've been left out of this inner circle?
There are certainly evangelical leaders or evangelicals who are critical of this effort. And there are many who are calling on these figures to distance themselves from the president. But they believe that being close to the president is more effective than walking away.
Jerome, how do you walk that fine line between honest journalism and partisanship? I mean, this one's got to be particularly tough, I would think.
This entire piece, and it's a long one, is entirely based on conversations with the participants involved. We let the facts speak for themselves. The only question is the legal status of the group. We pushed on that not out of any kind of partisan bent, but because we did ask the question. We were wondering, is this legal? And obviously it's not for us to decide, but it was worth noting that they have been careful not to have this group have an official status, and that official status would mean that there needs to be a certain amount of transparency about it.
Well, listen, it's a very, very helpful piece of journalism that you all have done. Jerome Sokolowski is a longtime journalist with deep experience in religion news and home and abroad. Since 2015, Jerome is the very busy editor-in-chief of Religion News Service, The comprehensive article, All the President's Clergymen, A Close Look at Trump's Unprecedented Ties with Evangelicals, is available at religionnews.com. Jerome, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks for giving some time to us and talking with us on State of Belief Radio again.
It was a pleasure as always, Welton, and you're doing great work on your show, and please keep it up.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. I'll talk with a Houston faith leader about interreligious relief efforts in the aftermath of the hurricane there. And up next, eye-opening new findings from the Public Religion Research Institute. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. When Dr. Robert P. Jones published his much-anticipated book, The End of White Christian America, in July of 2016, I think most of us believed that the demographic changes he painstakingly presented would be reflected in that fall's election. By the time the paperback edition emerged in July of 2017, we could clearly see that those changes were indeed impacting our nation, but in a very different way than we might have hoped. In recent weeks, new research from the Public Religion Research Institute, which Dr. Jones founded and continues to lead, reinforces both how much our nation has changed and how resistant to those changes some Americans continue to be. For an in-depth look at all of this, I'm happy to be joined once again by Robert Jones. Robbie, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Hi, Welton. Glad to be back with you.
The new report is titled America's Changing Religious Identity. And this is just full of eye-opening revelations, all of which seem to point to the fact that the surge in racial and religious backlash we've been seeing really is the last gasp of the formerly dominant demographic. Would you agree with that description?
Well, I mean, it is the way that I see it. It's interesting, like, the book was written well ahead of the election and captured really the front end of this trend. Just to give you an idea how quickly things have changed, though, so when I wrote the book, I was using 2014 data. And I had documented a decline in the percentage of Americans who identify as white, non-Hispanic, and Christian had declined from just, you know, two election cycles ago in 2008 from 54% of the country down to 47% of the country. So that's what I documented in the book. And so we crossed from this solid majority white Christian nation to a solidly non-majority white Christian nation. And that, you know, was a kind of tipping point that was important for us to pay attention to. But to give you a sense of the quick nature of this change, now we have 2015 and 2016 data that we just released in this new report, and that number of the percentage of white Christians in America has gone from 47% in 2014 to 45% in 2015 to 43% in 2016. Altogether, what that looks like is a change of 11 percentage points just across the last two presidential election cycle since 2008. It's more than a percentage point a year.
Good grief. Are you surprised by that?
You know, these trends have been with us really since the 1990s, so the trends aren't really new. But what I'm a little surprised about is how rapid they've moved, particularly, you know, in the last decade. And that part is new to us. And previously, the decline had been mostly, you know, up through the 1990s, even in early 2000s, had been mostly confined to the white mainline Protestant world, the more liberal end, you know, our progressive end, so Episcopalians and Congregationalists and that those groups. But more recently, we've seen, you know, what we've been calling a second wave of white Christian decline that has really accelerated it, and that is even among white evangelical Protestants, we're now seeing some, you know, decline over the last decade. And so it's now virtually all areas of white Christianity, white Catholics, white mainline Protestants, white evangelical Protestants, all of whom are basically losing younger members, they're aging, and overall shrinking over time.
So what groups are growing, and how big are their numbers today?
The biggest growth story, when you look at the trend lines, especially over the last decade, are among the religiously unaffiliated in the country. Today, they are 24% of the country. They are nearly a quarter of the country. They now are larger, for example, than white evangelical Protestants, white Catholics, white evangelicals. So, you know, they are the fastest growing and are now rivaling the size of what we tend to think about as the big pieces of the pie in the American religious landscape.
Hmm. Now, knowing what you know and that you've just talked about, can we forecast how these numbers are likely to change for Christians and non-Christians in the next decade or two?
Yeah, I mean, in short, I mean, I think what we're going to see is an America that's less Christian and less white, just to kind of put it bluntly. The best way of looking at this, you know, is to look at generational divides among Americans who are alive today. It's always difficult, you know, even if we've got a pretty solid trend line, to extend it out includes a lot of assumptions. But if you look at the generational breaks, I think etched in these generational divides are, you know, not a certain future, but a probable future. So if we look at seniors, for example, it is kind of striking that nearly two-thirds of seniors are white and Christian. Only 12% of them are religiously unaffiliated, right? So that looks like kind of America's religious past. If we look at the kind of millennial generation, those American adults under the age of 30, it's strikingly different. Only about a quarter of them identify as white and Christian, and nearly 4 in 10, 38%, identify as religiously unaffiliated. So if you just look at the unaffiliation numbers, the youngest Americans are three times as likely as the oldest American adults to be religiously unaffiliated.
My goodness. I'm intrigued by the geographic differences that you identify. There's a number of states where the religiously unaffiliated do outnumber now any other religious group. Am I reading that right?
No, that's correct. I mean, one of the nice things about this survey, which, you know, is a massive survey, it was it included interviews with over 100,000 Americans across 2016. And so it is kind of the largest survey of religious identity and denominational identity that's ever been conducted in the U.S. And we're well on our way to conducting, you know, the 2017 version. So we'll have more data to come next year. But one of the things we're able to do, because we have such a large sample size, is that we can actually look all the way down and compare state by state the changes. And what's notable about it is that there are now 20 states in which no religious group comprises a greater share of the residents than the religiously unaffiliated. They tend to be up in New England and out west, Vermont and Oregon and Washington, those kinds of states, New Hampshire. But they're not without their representatives in the middle of the country either.
Mm-hmm. Are there correlations between religious homogeneity and other characteristics like politics or the economy in individual states?
Well, you know, it's a really complicated picture, but, you know, we certainly do see, for example, we have a measure in the report of religious diversity, basically, and it measures how pluralistic, basically, a state is. So we see, for example, the states holding down the polls are the state of New York being the most religiously pluralistic state in the country, and the state of Mississippi, my home state, being the least religiously pluralistic, mostly because 60% of Mississippians identify as Baptist. So it's a very, very homogeneous, you know, much less Protestant, but it's a very homogeneous state. And obviously the state of New York and the state of Mississippi, they do have very, very different political profiles.
Sure. Yeah. Well, do these state-level findings tell us that we're becoming an ever more divided nation?
You know, I think the best way to look at that is, like, how does this fall out on you know, when we get to politics? And we have a whole section at the end of the report where we kind of take this up. And one of the things, you know, I would say that I think is something that just worries me as a citizen and someone who, like, would like to see a healthy democracy is the way that the two political parties are realigning themselves along the lines of race and religion. And you can see it moving even over the last decade. So what's happened is that the Democratic Party is kind of following the trends in the country. They're becoming less white and less Christian and sort of more religiously unaffiliated. So just to give you an example, the Democratic Party 10 years ago in 2006, half of Democrats identified as white and Christian. That number today is down to 3 in 10. So it's a loss of 20 percentage points in terms of their identity. The percentage of Democrats that identify as religiously unaffiliated has tripled over the last decade. It's gone from 9% to 26%. So a lot of changes in the Democratic Party that basically reflect the changes in the country. But Republicans, on the other hand, have stayed much closer to their original composition a decade ago. So they still look like they did 10 years ago, even while the Democratic Party's changing. So, for example, 10 years ago, the Republican Party was 81% white and Christian. Mm-hmm. Today, it remains 73% white and Christian. So you can see some, you know, shifts there, but that they're certainly not dramatic.
What in this research surprised you, and what in this research stands out to you as particularly noteworthy?
On the surprising question, I think this last report really did hammer home for me how much our anxieties over the changing face of the country, that they're less about religious diversity, you know, writ large. So, for example, if you take all of the non-Christian religious groups in the country, so Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, Sikhs, Jains, Muslims, and you put them all together, today they make up still less than 10% of the country. Hmm. So we're not having this kind of great cultural anxiety around the fact that the country's becoming 10% Muslim or 10% Jewish or, you know, 15% Hindu. It's not, that's not really what's happening. What I do think is happening is it's more a slippage from the top. It's this sense that this kind of white Protestant majority is no longer the cultural or demographic majority in the country. And I think it's that shift rather than this kind of explosion of religious pluralism that is really causing a lot of the reactions we're seeing in our politics. So I think that's one thing that really hammered home for me, just kind of looking at these numbers again.
Robbie, after we aired the interview at the time of your book, The End of White Christian America, was first released, among the feedback from listeners was one email that criticized us for even covering the issue. The writer worried that addressing the changes you described in your book would have the unintended consequence of energizing the groups that were so used to being in power. In all honesty, at the time, our response was that our commitment and responsibility is to cover important stories fairly and objectively. Not long ago, however, I saw a pretty shocking research article by some scholars in California that claims the following, and I want to read this from the abstract, if I may. Reminding white Christians high in ethnic identification that non-white racial groups will outnumber whites in the United States by 2042 caused them to become more concerned about the declining status and influence of white Americans as a group, and caused them to report increased support for Trump and anti-immigrant policies, as well as greater opposition to political correctness. Now, that made me consider rethinking my response to the listeners' concerns and to want to discuss this matter with you. So what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where I guess I'm of the conviction that it's, you know, if there's something brewing, let's just make it about a relationship, you know. So if, you know, you're in a kind of close, like, marital relationship with someone and you find yourself kind of always having these kind of big fights over stupid stuff, like who left the dishes in the sink and who, you know, left the towel on the bathroom floor. Sooner or later, you got to ask yourself the question, what are we really fighting about? Mm-hmm. Are we really fighting about the dishes? Are we really fighting about the towel? And there's usually something deeper, you know, in the relationship that is popping up in all these kind of unexpected ways. That was part of my motivation for writing the book in the first place, was that I had this sense that in our politics, we were already experiencing, you know, whether it was fights about immigration or health care or climate change. Like, there were many of these issues that there's no particular reason why they should be kind of partisan fights to the death, you know, is the way they tend to always fall out. But yet, you know, they just kept falling along these lines. And, you know, it occurred to me there was something already unhealthy going on in our politics. And I think, not to be too glib about it, but I think I was hoping that kind of getting it out in the open would lead us to having a healthier conversation about it, and just naming it and facing it was actually a healthier way to go than to sort of hope people don't notice, but still in their bones have these deep feelings of anxiety that they can't quite put their finger on the source. So I think that's what was my hope, is that the book actually sort of put something out in the open that people are actually already experiencing. And, you know, it may be that when you get something out in the open like that, things get worse before they get better. That just may be true. But I'm hoping in the long run, you know, if we all agree about what we're actually talking about, we can have more productive arguments and debates than otherwise.
In hindsight, I suppose it's not a great shock that the longstanding majority would not go down without a fight. The shock, I think, is just how big a fight they're willing to have. And this extends to things like affection for Vladimir Putin, as long as he helps them stay in power, accepting all kinds of violations of the rule of law, and I think potentially even abandoning the idea that the majority rules, which is so foundational to the concept of democracy. I don't want to go too far and ask you to speculate, but I think it's time we stop being shocked each and every time the dwindling majority betrays everything it claims to stand for, and instead to consider just how far it might be willing to go to hold on to power.
Yeah, you know, at the end of the book, I tried to wrestle with some of this, and, you know, what I ended up finding useful was I borrowed from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's Stages of Grief, how people react when they get, you know, a grim prognosis, which is, I think, effectively what white Christians have been handed, as a grim demographic prognosis about their continued dominance in the country. So how do people react to that? And, you know, what she charted out there, which I think we're seeing playing out in kind of macro ways, is people's first reactions tend to be denial and anger. And, you know, I think we're seeing plenty of that in our politics, a kind of anger fueled by denial, but constantly running up against hard facts that seem to reinforce the grim prognosis. But eventually, you know, as these processes go forward, the hope is that one gets past that. What typically follows is something like depression or bargaining. And one way of thinking about, I think, white evangelical support for Trump, which is just in so many ways inexplicable, right, given their professed values voters criteria for a candidate that had been so strong all the way from the 80s forward, is that they were striking a grand bargain, you know, with Trump as a way of kind of holding on to power, holding on to influence, even though it violated all kinds of principles that they themselves put forward. And, you know, if you get past that, though, hopefully down that road somewhere is acceptance. And I think our task as a country is to figure out, you know, how do we manage this transition? How do we help those who are, you know, angry and in denial to come to some kind of acceptance at the end of the day?
We live in an age of unbridled propaganda. How can we champion facts over fiction again?
Yeah, it's really difficult. I mean, I think we're seeing, you know, the investigations of Facebook that we're seeing right now that had hundreds and hundreds of Russian bots, you know, fake accounts run by Russian operatives, running paid advertisement to the tune of more than $100,000 to influence key states. That's something new that we really haven't had to deal with. And I think we're just beginning to kind of understand, you know, we would never let a Russian entity buy a paid television ad, you know, to run on a major network. But I think this backdoor of social media, which in many ways is more powerful than television or radio, particularly for anyone under the age of 50, we don't really have a good system, I think, of checking and guarding those things. And all of that is just one big problem. But then the kind of mutual reinforcement where, you know, you kind of get in your little tech bubble and everything you see is the same kind of news. You never really get anything other than the kinds of stuff you've already liked over the last 5 years. Those kinds of algorithmic news shuffling is, you know, another, I think, problem. It kind of tends to move people to the extreme. So I don't think I've got any great solutions. If I'm hopeful about anything, is that we are, I think, beginning to understand the digital world and its impact and the importance of it for a healthy democracy.
Dr. Robert P. Jones is the founding CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. You can find the entire report on America's changing religious identity, as well as the extraordinarily comprehensive American Values Atlas, at prri.org. Robbie's the author of the invaluable book, The End of White Christian America. The trends he identifies so articulately are currently defining every aspect of life in this country, and I think an understanding of these trends is absolutely necessary for making sense of our culture and our politics in 2017. Robbie, this is a massive piece of work, and it is so helpful, and I thank you for doing it, and I thank you for being with us often on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thanks, Walton. Those are really kind words. But it's been, been a privilege to kind of walk this journey with you. So thank you.
FEMA and other government agencies sprang into action after the recent hurricanes, earning widespread applause for their work, rightfully so. Still, there's a need for much more than official channels can offer. Again and again, we see faith-driven action across denominational lines making the difference. And I wanted to take a closer look at what's been happening in Houston since Hurricane Harvey and the flooding that followed. Joining me now is the Reverend Gregory Hahn, Director of Interfaith Relations at Interfaith Ministries for Greater Houston. Greg, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Would you start with a quick overview of Interfaith Ministries for Greater Houston? Whom is that made up of, and what are the agendas that you normally focus on?
We describe ourselves as Houston's oldest interfaith service organization. We date our roots back to the mid-1950s. The strength of shared beliefs and dialogue, collaboration, and service are our two mottos. So we've done a variety of service and advocacy work over the past 50 years. Currently, our two major service areas are we run Harris County's largest Meals on Wheels program. It's about the fifth largest in the nation, as well as a very robust refugee services resettlement program. I direct out of the Department of Interfaith Relations and Community Partnerships, the interfaith relations aspect, mobilizing, educating, resourcing, connecting. That's a lot of the work that we do. So right now, our work primarily has been within the organization, getting especially Meals on Wheels up and running, knowing that a lot of our clients live in vulnerable communities, as well as checking in on our refugees. And a lot of my work has been coordinating and resourcing with the faith communities and just being really proud of their responses in the wake of Hurricane Harvey.
What was the response you were able to muster when the hurricane hit Texas?
We were able to muster, I think, an incredible response in two aspects. First, getting our own important direct services up and running, but also this is where all of the time that it takes to build relationships really makes a difference, because you don't want to be calling and connecting with somebody when there is a community need. You want to have those relationships in place long before that. We're unique in many ways, the Greater Houston area, with our religious diversity and also with the connections that they make. So I have been personally so proud and pleased with the initiative and the compassion and the grit that our faith communities have already took. You know, Harvey started as a tropical wave August 13th, and as it grew and with hurricanes, you've got an opportunity to see what's coming and to prepare. And I just started hearing and seeing all of these different responses, preparatory responses. My favorite with preparation was a mosque that went over to a church just next door and sandbagged the doors to the church. Mm. And then in the response, so many churches and so many mosques in particular opened up right away as shelters, as distribution centers, said our doors are open, and also said if you cannot worship in your space post-Harvey, you are welcome in our space. Mm. Those sorts of responses have been incredible, and a lot of the work that I've been doing is trying to keep track, trying to help people stay connected, folks who have resources saying, hey, we have an abundance of hygiene items. Do you know a place that needs them? Trying to get them connected and just trying to keep information flowing. So a lot of the work has been done by our incredible religious communities across religious traditions.
Mm. I think most of us spent a lot of time watching the television reports coming from Houston. What was it like in the hours and days after the storm in Houston?
It's exhausting. It really is for really everybody, whether you were affected or not affected. It's just mentally very taxing. Obviously, it's physically very taxing, especially for people who were affected. And then for everybody, really, and I don't use that general everybody term lightly, really wanted to, if they weren't affected, how can I help? I don't know anybody that I've talked to, regardless of level of impact Hurricane Harvey had. And for us, it wasn't necessarily the hurricane, it was the flooding. And just that inexorable watch for so many people of that water rise. And is it going to stop? Is it not? It's receded, but then our reservoirs were overloaded in some areas, and we've had a controlled release so that there wouldn't be an uncontrolled release out of the reservoir. So here comes the water again. Will it rise? Here it comes. It's at my doorstep. It's an inch. It's at 2 inches. When's it going to stop? So watching something that you can't stop. Should I evacuate now? Should I have evacuated then? So it's just, I think, really mentally exhausting, and we all have felt we just don't know what day it is. I've just now begun to get a sense of the rhythms of the week where I can keep track of the days. The last 2 weeks, I have had no idea what day it is, and I think that goes for so many people.
Greg, what are the biggest challenges to interreligious cooperation, whether in a disaster or in the longer term, in your experience?
Here in Houston, and again, I know that there are ups and downs with interreligious dialogue and engagement. I have seen really great work across religious lines, and I'm talking Christian, Muslim, Jewish, as well as I know that varieties of faiths out of all of those traditions have been active. I'm also the Sikh community, the Zoroastrian community, the Hindu community. And I have to also say folks who are unaffiliated, our Humanists of Houston community has been also incredibly active in service. I think for us, a lot of it is logistical. We are such a spread out region, 600 square miles just for the city of Houston, our 10 county regions larger than the state of New Jersey. I think a lot of our obstacles are purely logistics, trying to keep track of what's going on where and trying to keep people connected, honoring the work that they're doing community-wise, but also trying to help people stay connected on a larger regional basis.
How in the world does IFGH address those kinds of challenges?
We do our best. I describe our work as not necessarily just a hub, but also a node in a larger network. Hmm. I've lived in a variety of places in the United States, and there is really a can-do attitude, a sense of individualism, but also a deep sense of community, of looking out for one another. So it's sort of in our, I think, Houston's lifeblood to be active and engaged, not necessarily waiting for somebody, but also then to say, hey, neighbor, or hey, local neighborhood, or hey, local community, let's get organized and take care of what we can take care of. So we have not had to, in a lot of ways, be that impetus. Hopefully we've been that impetus and that drive with the decades of work that we've done building relationships. so that we've already kind of greased the wheels for service to take place. So I think we are relying not on new connections, but on these connections we've taken a long time to build and maintain and then expand, and then letting those connections naturally work and for folks that are in areas of great need connect. And then we use our connections to then do the larger connective work. But again, I have been so proud and amazed of the initiative that the faith communities have done. In some ways, we're leading it, but we're also just trying to enable it.
If you get a time to just sit and think about what's happened, what's the best thing you think about that?
I think there's two things, and I think both as kind of my work as a kind of nonprofit professional, but also my work as a pastor. The first is the outpouring of generosity and compassion and just at hard work. And honestly, also, that there was already a level of organization in place, not specifically like disaster plans, though some faith communities had disaster plans, but they just got up and running and said, we're going to figure this out, and we're going to figure this out together. So that has been a greatly, greatly heartening. And on the other side, just still the strength and the necessity of faith communities with their spiritual capital that they provide to a community. And I use spiritual in an expansive sense, as well as the sheer, still the reminder and the necessity of faith communities for social capital, that they are still necessary. And I think then what Harvey has done for faith communities, it has been a little bit of a wake-up call for many of us as to remind us, why do we exist in the first place? And if we don't exist in order to be connective tissue, responsive organizations and places of hope, then why are we in this business in the first place? So I see it as hope. I see it as a reminder of the importance of faith communities, using that word again expansively, and also a wake-up call, a reminder for many faith communities to say, why do we exist when we need to be better at existing for those reasons?
The Reverend Gregory Hahn is Director of Interfaith Relations at Interfaith Ministries for Greater Houston, IMGH, was at the forefront of disaster recovery across denominational lines after Hurricane Harvey struck that area a couple of weeks ago. Greg, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity, and I appreciate your work.
Before we go, the past several weeks have not been easy in many different ways. I don't have to tell you that. Many of our listeners have been brutally hammered and frighteningly flooded by extraordinarily strong hurricanes. Wind gusts now have calmed, and incessant rains have given way to blue skies. But victims of the storms still face losses of property and irreplaceable material possessions, even as they struggle with emotions that hurt the heart, and impose a feeling that getting to the future is almost insurmountable. We've thought of those of you in that situation, as well as prayed for you. We've sent money for your use in beginning to clean away debris and begin to build again. Dealing with deadly destructive hurricanes and seeking to replace what seems to be irreplaceable are more than enough for anyone to have to cope with. However, since the 2000 presidential election, we've had to deal not only with the storms of nature, but also with the dangerous storms of politics that threaten the integrity of our Constitution. The president in the Oval Office today has no understanding of or sensitivity to the ugly ramifications of using U.S. tax dollars to fund reparations for houses of worship and religious organizations damaged by the fury of nature. Now, more than ever, government needs to do its job and let the religious community do our job without confusing the two. Many politicians still do not understand religion or the Constitution. Religious people and our institutions do not need government officials calling us to service in the midst of a tragedy. In most instances, we got to the most desperate places before the government did. And we did not show up wanting the government to pay us for doing what we are called by a higher power to do. The religious community has been focused on comforting the grieving, caring for the hurting, housing the displaced, finding jobs for those without paychecks, and speaking of hope to the despairing. Now, we also have to contend with political opportunists like the president taking advantage of a national tragedy to push their agenda for government funding of favored religions, a policy that's never been approved by the Congress or the courts. Using government money in such an unconstitutional manner raises profound questions about the constitutional mandate related to the separation of the institutions of religion and government, political expediency, accountability, and the possible specter of government officials inspecting the financial records of houses of worship to determine which religious bodies will receive tax dollars, how much the reimbursements will be, how those funds can be spent, and what kind of obligation the religious bodies will have to the government agencies that have given them money. Loud voices are calling for government funds to be channeled directly through houses of worship and other pervasively sectarian organizations to meet the critical needs of people impacted by the storms and floods. Such a plan would violate the spirit and the letter of the Constitution, though some politicians have discovered that tearing down Thomas Jefferson's wall of separation between church and state is good for politics and good for dividing people. In short, it helps win elections. Now, why should a Baptist minister oppose freeing up federal funds for supporting religious causes, especially in a crisis moment? Let me tell you. It is because I know, I have experienced up close the erosion of democracy and the mess of political manipulation of money that occurs in such a situation. I am concerned precisely because I care about the independence and integrity of our nation's religious community and appreciate religion's ability to be a source of healing. Look, government has a vital role to play in aiding the recovery necessary after the destruction of these storms. Government needs to be busy doing what government should do, providing basic social services, rebuilding sewage systems, hospitals, arteries for transportation, educational institutions, and other key components of the infrastructure. Do that work and leave those of us in the religious community alone. We know what to do, and we're doing it. This is our calling. We welcome the government working with us in a partnership that doesn't entangle religion and government by the government seeking to fund us. Regardless of how well-intentioned the action, government cannot and should not fund or do the work of religion. As the pastor of a church in Monroe, Louisiana, when Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, I was privileged to work alongside members of my congregation and other members of our community in a variety of relief efforts involving spiritual, logistical, and financial issues. During those trying days, I saw the government at its best and at its worst. President Bush insisted on using government money to support religious ministries. I remember who got that money. Conservative Christian congregations whose pastors had supported the Bush administration. I listened to the rage of pastors in New Orleans whose desperately needed ministries were overlooked for what they knew were political reasons. Minority religions? No, they had little chance to be supported. We cannot trust this White House to provide what religious institutions really need. If money is involved, political loyalties, campaign strategies, and noticeable biases will be as apparent as will be another way of weakening our democracy. The constitutional guarantees of freedom for religion and freedom from religion have done more good for religion, the nation, and religion-based charity than ever can be accomplished by direct government funding for politically favored religious organizations. My friends, we must not allow even acts of compassion to erode the authority and the promise of our historic Constitution. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you haven't, I encourage you to do so. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it. Direct those friends of yours that need to be listening to State of Belief to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that?